This week's Sound Off is brought to you by Audible.com. Do you guys like reading? Sometimes it can be a little cumbersome, right? I find it hard sometimes to read books, newspapers, whatever. Sometimes you just don't have the time. Well, I got a great solution for you. Why not have somebody read a book to you? That's how lazy we've become, but not really. It's actually pretty cool. Audible has a huge selection of books, over 100,000 wrestling titles, crime novels, science fiction novels, whatever floats your boat, all for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or other device. You can help support this podcast. Go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. They have a free trial for 30 days you can sign up for right now. And as part of that trial, you get a free audio book. Whatever book you want that they have up in their store, check it out. And you can give it a try. I think you're going to like it. audibletrial.com/solomonster for your free trial and audio book right now. The Solomonster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 314 of the Solomonster Sounds Off. Here for Sunday, February 16th. 2014. I am the Solomonster. You, of course, can listen to this podcast in full every single week on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, or in iTunes. And we also have a free Android app in the Google Play Store for those of you with Android devices. I want to give a quick mention here at the top of the show. I've gotten a lot of questions about this over the last 12 hours or so. I know many of the people who listen to this podcast originally found out about the show through the TV Tracks channel on YouTube. TV Tracks had permission to post clips from the Sound Off, among other shows. And we've gotten a lot of new listeners that way. It was one of the bigger channels on YouTube when it came to wrestling-related content. You know, thousands of subscribers. And I've gotten a ton of emails from people telling me, you know, I was first exposed to your show through TV Tracks and came to love it. Now I listen to the full shows. So you can imagine I was very surprised when I started getting messages last night from people saying, oh, you know, TV Tracks is terminated. It's not up anymore. And apparently YouTube went and terminated the channel. And I have absolutely no idea why they would have done that. All the content that's up there is posted with permission. There's no copyright infringement or anything like that going on. So all I can tell you is, you know, I've reached out to find out what's going on. It's being addressed. There is a dialogue going on back and forth between he and YouTube. So there's really not much else to say about it right now and really nothing to do. I think just kind of let the process work itself out. And hopefully, you know, I don't know how long it may take or if it's even going to happen. The hope is that perhaps the channel can be restored. Things can go back to the way they were. I don't know if that will happen or not. So I just wanted to give a quick update. I know many of you, again, are fans of that channel. You've become fans of my show because of the content on there. And a lot of questions, a lot of people who just don't know what's going on. So the update is there is no major update right now. It's being addressed. There's really nothing more that you or I could do at this point. If that changes, I'll be sure to give an update on the show next week. I want to give some PayPal shout-outs up front really quickly here to the people who have donated to the Sound Off. We didn't have a lot last week. It's the opposite this week. We had a ton of people who gave, and I want to thank them for that. Brendan Lorbach, Luke Goguen, Jason Rule, Carlos Manuel, Chuck Lentz, Islam Mohammed, David Vera, Trevon Clark, and Zachary Newman all contributed to the show this week. So I want to say thank you, as I've done already in some cases, but I want to say thank you here on the show to each one of those people for donating. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you can do so at any time on thesolomonster.com. The donation box is there. You can give in, you know, whatever currency is native to where you may be. Give as much or as little as you can. Every little bit helps to keep the show going. So I just want to say thank you. I was actually out last night when I got these messages about TV Tracks. I happened to be out at an independent show here in Brooklyn. A friend of mine actually wrestles for the Johnny Rods promotion, which is the World of Unpredictable Wrestling, which, if you see some of the characters that were on the show last night, it was kind of unpredictable. They had a tie-in with CMLL, so they had some talent from Mexico. Super Crazy, who is now, I believe, with Pro Wrestling Noah, many of you know from the old ECW and a little bit in WWE. He was on the show. Matt Stryker was on the show. Matt Stryker got his start really through Johnny Rods and has always stayed loyal to him. And he was there in action. I got the chance to meet him briefly, which was kind of cool. And A lot of good action. It's just fun, you know. I don't get out nearly as much as I probably should, so I should probably take my own advice. But I always tell people when they say, oh, you know, this indie is coming to my town and so-and-so's going to be on the card, you know, a couple of old guys or whatever. I don't know if I should go. What should I do? And I always kind of laugh at that. It's like, unless they're charging ridiculous prices for their tickets, and I don't know too many indie promotions that are charging ridiculous prices, go ahead. I mean, what have you got to lose? You know, if it's close by, if it's easy enough for you to go, if there's a few name people on the show that you think would be cool to see live and in person, then go ahead. You know, take advantage of it. There are some people who listen to the show who are in places where they don't have a lot of events like this that come to their town. So I always tell people, if you can make it, and if the price is reasonable, absolutely, you know, go out and support your local indie promotion. And more often than not, it turned out to be a fun night. Last night was a fun night, getting to see those guys. And ironically, both Matt Stryker and Super Crazy both ended up winning championships. I think Stryker won the WUW light heavyweight title. I think, I could be wrong. And Super Crazy won their world title in the main event. So it was cool. It was cool to see the mix of the Mexican talent and their kind of their usual talent that they have working their way up the ranks. Some big guys, too, on this show. They would walk out. One guy was 6'8", the other guy was 7 feet, you know, in a triple threat match with a guy who was about as big as I am. And I could tell you I am not 6'8". So you get a very eclectic mix of talent. And it's been a while since I've been out at an indie show, so a lot of fun last night. No update on the WWE television rights deal. Friday was the deadline for Comcast to submit their final bid for WWE programming. Now they have the option to either sign that deal, WWE does, or open negotiations with other broadcast partners. That's kind of where we're at. Comcast does have the right to match any offer that's made, which is really the ideal situation for WWE, because all that does is jack up the price. If there's any interest at all from another partner, whether it's Spike TV or if it's, you know, Bravo or Disney or whoever these other supposed broadcast partners are that they've spoken with before, according to an article in Variety a few months ago, all that's going to do is jack up their price. You know, when Vince McMahon promised the investors a few months ago, we're going to at least double what we make now. So they're kind of under the gun here. They better hope they're able to double it, or else they're going to look bad, and that stock price is probably going to come down from the highs that it's been at recently. But I think they're in a really good spot right now. They're not planning on announcing who the deal is with until April or May. My guess is that news is going to leak a lot sooner than that. So that's the update on the TV situation. Monday Night Raw was live from Los Angeles this past week. Go through the good, the bad, and the ugly here. Some random Raw observations. There were false reports of Shelton Benjamin beating Tyson Kidd in a dark match before the show. Turns out, not true, didn't happen. Some loser online, I guess, just started that rumor. There were a lot of things to like about this show. It had a hot crowd in L.A., which always makes things more fun. Sheamus and Christian had a match against the Real Americans. Best match of the night, just a great match. And we had an awesome confrontation between The Shield and the Wyatt family. All of you that I've heard from have had nothing but positive, glowing things to say about that segment. It wasn't a match. They never touched. It was great build-up to their match coming up at the Elimination Chamber. It was just classic pro wrestling build. It was great. It was great, great stuff. We'll talk about that more in a second. Betty White. Betty White was on the show as the special guest star, guest host, whatever her title was. Betty White was kind of a waste. You know, still very cool to see her doing her thing at 92. I've always been a fan of hers. I used to watch reruns of Match Game with her on it back when was it Gene Rayburn, I think, hosted that show, which was before my time. Again, I wasn't watching it when that show aired originally, but, you know, with Game Show Network and stuff like that, you can watch old game shows, and she was one of the people that was all over that game. I don't think people quite understand the kind of TV icon this woman is. I mean, she's got a show now that's on, TV Land, and she's still doing TV stuff. But she has been on so many different shows over the course of her career. It's just, it's crazy. If you look up her, I'm sure it must be on her Wikipedia page. It'll probably have a whole list of all the things that she's done. It's just absolutely ridiculous. You know, The Golden Girl, she's probably most well known for that show. I hated that show like the plague when I was a kid because my grandmother would watch it all the time. It wasn't exactly in my demographic back then. And still not in my demographic now, I guess. But you know what? I will watch that show now in reruns, and it's great. It's great. It's one of the funniest sitcoms I've ever seen. And she was a big part of that. The key with that show, of course, was great writing, which was definitely lacking here on this show. Now, listen, here's the thing. I get that the show she was there to promote was a show about pranks. Actually, now that I think about it, when I mentioned before that she's on TV now, I wasn't even thinking about the prank show. I was thinking about a completely different show. So she's got her meat hooks in a couple of different TV things these days. But she was there to promote a show where I think old people play pranks on people. I think that's the whole basis of it. And so they wanted her in a skit where she played a prank on somebody. Okay, fine, it makes sense. Did we really need a storyline where Billy Gunn shits himself? Really? That's the best you could come up with? That was the big punchline for Betty White's appearance on this show. They spike her drink with a laxative, and she switches it on them. Ooh, wow, riveting writing there. I swear, if WWE's writers were responsible for writing any of the shows that Betty White has been on during the course of her career, that show would not have lasted half a season. That is a fact. Daniel Bryan got a Road Warrior pop from the crowd when his music hit, and he came out during the Authority segment at the start of the show. That's what I wrote on Twitter, and I thought about it. I said, did he really get a Road Warrior pop? Am I embellishing it too much? You know, do we need to protect the sanctity of that term, Road Warrior pop? And I thought about it, and I said, you know what? The Road Warriors used to get a big reaction from the crowd wherever they would go back in the 80s and the NWA when they were first starting out and they were hot and everything else. And Daniel Bryan now, I'm not comparing who sold more tickets and all that kind of stuff. I'm just saying, when he walks out, what kind of reaction does the guy get in most cities? He gets a monster reaction. So you know what? He gets the modern-day version of a Road Warrior pop. I don't think there's anything wrong with calling it that. And it's going to be louder in certain cities than others. L.A. was a hot crowd. They loved Daniel Bryan. They couldn't, you know, they were chanting. Yes, they were chanting his name. They were going crazy. They played things up further between him and Triple H, with Triple H giving him the night off, much to the crowd's chagrin. He did come back later in the show to beat up Kane and get revenge for Kane laying him out the week before on TV. So I assume this is going to lead to a match between the two of them on an upcoming Raw. Maybe the February 24th show, which is fixing to be a very big night for the company. They're really loading up that show. Or maybe they hold it out off for a hot crowd in Chicago on March 3rd. Obviously, it's not going to be Bryan and Kane at WrestleMania, so it's going to have to be on, I would think, one of those two shows coming up. He's in a top spot on the show right now, is Daniel Bryan. I like what they're doing with him. They're keeping him in the top mix. I still say finish the story you started. Get him in that title picture somehow. Maybe they will after the Chamber. I am withholding judgment until I see what they do there. So I can't really complain about that. He's in a good position right now, and we'll see what they do with him in the next couple of weeks. The Wyatts beat Rey Mysterio and the Rhodes Brothers. Another good match with an awesome finish. Mysterio was going for a 619 on Luke Harper. Unbeknownst to poor Rey, Harper had blind tagged Bray Wyatt. And as soon as Rey bounced off the ropes, Wyatt caught him with a super quick Sister Abigail. Just killed him with the move. He keeps doing that. He's going to turn himself babyface. But that was a great finish. Wyatts get the win. I like the interplay with The Shield backstage. They had a segment here where Renee Young interviewed The Shield. Roman Reigns, you know, calling Renee Young baby girl. I'll try using that line when I'm in New Orleans for Mania. We'll see if that works. He starts teasing Dean Ambrose about never defending the U.S. title. He's kind of ribbing him a little bit. And Ambrose says, you know, it's just a pain in the ass to fill out all the paperwork whenever I have to defend this championship. So then he issued an open challenge to anybody in the back who wants to take the title from him. I had read, as many of you did, I'm sure, that Rob Van Dam was backstage at the show. Earlier that day, he was meeting with Triple H to see if they have anything for him for WrestleMania this year. I don't know what was said. RVD left before the show, I think before the show even started. So I don't know what that means. I don't even know where you would fit him into any WrestleMania plans. I'm sure you could find a spot for him. He's, you know, a good player to have. But anyway, I figured it would be RVD coming out and challenging him for the title. Instead, it was the returning Mark Henry. They had a boring match. Shield interfered, saved the title. Reigns speared the hell out of Mark Henry on the outside. And then as the Shield went to leave through the crowd, the lights went out, and out comes the Wyatt family. And like I said earlier, this was the best segment on the entire show. This was the best possible way you could have built up something between the two teams. Now, on Raw this week and maybe SmackDown, maybe they'll touch. You know, maybe there'll be a big brawl between the Shield and the Wyatts. And maybe that isn't even the worst thing in the world. You have a very brief brawl that gets broken up by referees and stuff. You know, they could touch, but you don't want to give away too much. But I liked what they did here. They never touched. They never even went face-to-face, nose-to-nose. The way they set this whole thing up was just perfect, because if you really paid attention, you noticed that Roman Reigns was clearly positioned as the leader of the Shield. As Roman went, so did Seth and Dean. So when Roman took a step, so did the two of them. And same thing with Bray Wyatt, you know. He told his guys, all right, get up on the apron. They followed his lead. He is, after all, a cult leader. And it was very, very clear that Bray Wyatt is the leader of the Wyatt family, and Roman Reigns is the leader of the Shield. And I watched this, and I listened to the reaction of the crowd, and obviously they have big plans for Reigns, the way they're pushing him, and, you know, he's got this that look that they like and whatever. I think Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt are going to be the top guys for the next era. I don't want to say, oh, they're the next John Cena, Randy Orton, but they probably will be that, I think, for this next era coming up, whatever name you want to give this era. Because they're that good, you know, and they're not going to go away anytime soon. I'm sure one or both of them will be a world champion, probably both of them at some point. But I'm just saying, 5 years from now, 10 years from now is a long time, but you look down the road, would not shock me at all if these two guys here were the two guys for this next era coming up, and I like the way that they're positioning them now. And clearly they've got big plans for Bray if he's going to go up against Cena at WrestleMania. Reigns, once he breaks away from the Shield, I'm sure they're going to push him as, you know, the next big coming-of-age babyface in the company. But this was great. This was so great. The Wyatts ultimately backed off, so they kind of positioned the Shield here as the babyfaces in this feud. So they're not quite babyfaces, but they want you to cheer them. It was very apparent they want you to cheer for them at the pay-per-view and not the Wyatts. At least that's how I read it. I asked this question on Twitter. I wonder if WWE would be bold, if that's even the right word, and extend the Shield versus Wyatt angle through WrestleMania. Keep that going for a little bit longer. Change the card around. Do Undertaker and John Cena maybe instead of Cena and Bray Wyatt. You can always do Cena and Bray Wyatt at some point, you know, a month or two later. It doesn't have to be done at WrestleMania. So you do Taker Cena, which I still think is the biggest match you could do with Undertaker at this point, and add Daniel Bryan into the title mix with Orton and Batista, maybe make that a three-way. Because, again, I think Orton and Batista by itself, if that's your main event, is going to fail. So you've got to make some kind of change, and the most obvious one would be to get Daniel Bryan in there somehow. I just think Wyatt and Shield could have more juice to it, especially after what I saw there last Monday. There's a lot of excitement for that match, which is cool because it's a match that involves all new guys, all, you know, younger guys. There's no old veteran, there's no Randy Orton, John Cena, CM Punk, Big Show, Kane, or anybody like that. It's all, you know, the newer guys, and the fans are legit pumped up for it, and it's really cool to see. So it would almost be a waste, I think, to do a one-and-done type of thing, have the one match, and then move on. You can do that match between them, do another match at WrestleMania, and you can still do whatever they're going to do at Roman Reigns. So if they're going to break up the Shield that night or the night after on Raw, you could still do that. You know, you could still, that doesn't have to change. You could still keep that plan. I guess if you change the card around and you do that, you can match Brock, because, you know, you got to have something for Brock Lesnar to do. You can match Brock up with somebody like Sheamus. I wouldn't mind a Brock-Sheamus match. I think that would be kind of hard-hitting, maybe a little stiff. And just not have Triple H wrestle on the card at all. I know that's an impossibility. Triple H has to have his match. You know what? If CM Punk comes back, and it's entirely possible that they will maybe reach an understanding with him, and he'll make a surprise appearance in Chicago on March 3rd, if they can get Punk back, you could do him in Triple H. You could go back to the original plan, have him wrestle Hunter, and just do that. But I got to be honest with you, I will not be devastated if Triple H does not wrestle on the card this year. I mean, is WrestleMania really going to suffer by not having a Triple H match? I don't agree with the sentiment that the match he had with Brock last year, and I was at that show at MetLife Stadium, him and Brock, which I think was the second match, I think, of their feud. I didn't think that match was anything special. I really didn't. The cage match to blow off the feud a few months later was a little bit better. It was a better match. But, you know, Triple H got his win at WrestleMania. That's all that anybody's going to remember. That's all fine and good. But I just didn't think it was that great of a match. You know, the matches with Undertaker that he had at 27 and 28 were good. I think the 27 one was better. But it's not like when Shawn Michaels retired. When Shawn Michaels retired, we really missed out on, I think, a lot of other great matches. I think the guy could probably still go. I think you put him in the ring with a guy like Bryan or one of the Shield members or Ziggler or whoever, and you're going to have a kick-ass match. I don't feel the same way about Triple H. Like, oh my God, if Triple H isn't on the show, what are we going to do? We're not going to have that marquee match. Nah, I really won't give a shit. So if you have to change plans, if you want to blow up the card and you want to reshuffle things around a little bit, and you look and you say, well, Hunter doesn't have a match. Well, who gives a fuck? The card is not going to suffer if he doesn't have a match. I don't mind it if he does, but he doesn't have to be on there. Don't let that, you know, prevent you from changing plans. I would still do Brock and Bryan in a perfect world. I still would love to see that as the main event for the championship. I'm just trying to be realistic here and come up with a card that I think could, I could reasonably see them putting together if they wanted to, which is why I said maybe just stick Bryan in the whole Batista-Orton thing. So anyway, it's just something I floated on Twitter. I was thinking about it as a way to maybe keep the Shield Wyatt thing going, reshuffle things. You could say, oh, it's too late. WrestleMania is a month and a half away. It's never too late. It really is never too late. It's their company. They could do what they want. If they wanted to blow up the card 3 weeks before the pay-per-view, they could do that. I don't think they will, but just a thought. I did notice one thing in the Observer newsletter this week. There was a note that Mark Crozier, who wrote and performed the Wyatt Family theme song, he's going to be playing that song for them live at WrestleMania. He'll be doing their ring entrance, so I think that could be very cool. I mentioned the Real Americans against Sheamus and Christian. All action here. Just great stuff. Christian looked no less than 1,000 years old. I don't know what the hell happened to this guy. Lance Storm, who was once tag team partners with Christian on Twitter, said he looked jaundiced. He did look ill. I was a little worried for his health. Christian, he appeared to be near death for some reason. I don't know if it was the black eye that he had or the hair or what it is, but facially he looked terrible. Yeah, maybe Vince McMahon should put that blue dot over his face after all. I don't know. The other story here was Antonio Cesaro, who is no longer Antonio Cesaro. He is now known simply as Cesaro. Personally, I don't care. If it's a sign that they're finally getting behind the guy, you could call him Mud for all I care. Crowd was really into him. They were into the Cesaro swing, and he got a clean win over Randy Orton on SmackDown, which he needed to build up his credibility heading into the Elimination Chamber. I didn't see it as being anything more than that. I just looked at it and said, okay, the guy's in the chamber. Clearly, you're going to have some fans who don't buy him or Christian being in there with those other guys. It's Cesaro's first pay-per-view main event. We got to do something. We got to do something to make it seem like he belongs in there. And so they decided to give him a clean win over Orton. That's how I looked at it. But still, a huge win. I saw the match. I loved the match. I thought the match was really good. And the finish was great. The finish was great because it came out of nowhere. You know, Orton went for the RKO. He didn't hit it. Cesaro got, you know, the uppercut on Orton, hit the neutralizer. And I still say that the uppercut should be his finish, but hit the neutralizer, 1, 2, 3. I was stunned. I was expecting a distraction, or there was nothing. No interference, no Jack Swagger, no distraction, no slipping on a banana peel, nothing. Just beat him clean in the middle. And got a good reaction for it, and it felt like a big deal. And that was really cool. And hopefully it is a sign of things to come, and not just, oh, we have to do something to build this guy for the chamber, and then we're just going to, you know, slot him right back down where he belongs. I don't expect him to be fighting for the world title in the next few months, but again, hopefully a sign of things to come, and a sign that at some point soon they've got to turn this guy babyface. I think the time has come for him to make the turn. I don't know if you turn him and Swagger both babyface, keep them together for a while. I do like their team. I hate to break them up, but you know, I think the time is right. You know, sometime between now and WrestleMania, the time is right to make the move. I suggested when Sheamus came back, I thought Sheamus should come back as a heel. Punk went away, and all of a sudden, I think Sheamus probably should stay a babyface for now because they need babyfaces. But at some point, I would not mind them doing a feud between Sheamus and Cesaro because I think they could have good matches. But somewhere in the course of that feud, you do a double turn. So maybe it's 2-3 months down the road. You do a double turn. Sheamus goes heel, Cesaro goes face. They did a double turn with Del Rio and Dolph last year. I think doing one with these two guys would make sense because I still think that Sheamus is doing real well right now. He's getting good reactions, but he's still relatively new. He was gone for a few months. He's back. He's in that honeymoon period. Unless they have something really big planned for Sheamus, he's going to fall right back into that rut he was in before he left, where they didn't have anything to do for him. He was just kind of there. He feuded with the Road Scholars. Remember that? He wasn't doing anything. The injury, in some ways, was maybe the best thing that could have happened to him. Now he's back, and he's in the world title chamber match. What happens after the chamber match when he loses? You know, are they going to put him in a feud with Ryback, which is what I'm reading? Do they have a plan for the guy, or are they just going to slot him in some multi-man match? They have to have something for him to do. I don't think these great fan reactions are going to last very long. I think, ultimately, what's going to probably work out better for him is to turn him heel. So, again, the double turn is just a thought. But back to Cesaro. So now he's got the one name. He's not the only one. Big E Langston now is no more Langston. It's now just Big E. So clearly Vince McMahon must have been on his period this week. It's the only thing I could come up with. A little moody, a little hormonal. And then there's the sad story of Dolph Ziggler. Crowd was into him on Monday when he came out, even though they cut his entrance short like a jobber. Alberto Del Rio pinned him in 90 seconds. And Alberto Del Rio himself has been treated like a jabroni the last few weeks. So the fact that Dolph would go in there, and it was almost like Del Rio was back to being a main eventer the way he treated this poor bastard. You know, beat him in 90 seconds with his move. After the match, actually he didn't beat him with the arm breaker, he kicked him in the head, which is how he beat him for the belt last year. Then he put the arm breaker on him after the match until Batista came out and made the save. Then on Tuesday, Ziggler wrestles in a dark match at the SmackDown taping, and he loses to Alexander Rusev. So we'll see if we get a Miz Ziggler tag team, which has been another rumor going around. Miz popped up again on this show complaining to the announcers that he doesn't have a match, yet Fandango and Santino do, and you know what's wrong with that, and then he walked off. There's been nothing done on TV with Ziggler in that same direction. They clearly hate the guy's guts. I can't figure out why. You know, even if the guy says stuff that rubs people the wrong way, there's no good reason to bury this dude this way. And that word gets thrown around a lot. Okay, I agree with people that the word bury is overused. I defy you to come up with a better word to use in the case of Dolph Ziggler. What the hell else would you call it? He won the world title the night after WrestleMania, and a year later, you've got him wrestling in dark matches and losing. I mean, what did this guy do or say that was so bad? And it's the inconsistency that drives me nuts because, okay, he's been treated this way for a while. After a while, you just kind of accept it for what it is. I mean, what the hell are you going to do? But, you know, a few weeks ago, he cut that promo on the app, and I think they put it on the website. They never aired it on TV. Michael Cole talked about it for like 5 seconds and moved on. So he did that promo, that very passionate promo, and he may have even cut another promo on TV, and he went out and he won a match, and maybe he won another match. So it looked like, okay, finally, they're acknowledging this losing streak, this horrific losing streak that he's been on. They're acknowledging it on commentary. They're not having him acknowledge it on TV. That must mean that there's a story here, and they're going to go somewhere with it. Nope. Right back to what he was doing before, losing. Losing in 90 seconds. So yeah, it's like, make up your fucking mind. Are you going to turn this into a storyline and start the redemption of Dolph Ziggler and have him work his way back up from nothing to something? Or are you just going to job the guy out? Because if you're just going to job the guy out, then don't tease us like that. It's like the Daniel Bryan thing, you know? Go back to that. They love to talk about how we're storytellers. We tell great stories. And the Bryan thing, it was a good story, and maybe they'll come back to it at some point because of all the fan pressure that's been put on them. But clearly, they had no intention of finishing that story out the way they should have. Even if Bryan didn't win the championship, which you would think would be the ultimate ending to the story, you know, to get him back into the title picture, no. No. Maybe they'll be forced into doing it. But here, it's like, okay, you're going to tell a story that this guy was way up here, his whole world collapsed, he hit rock bottom, and now he's going to work his way back up. And then 2 weeks later, you change your mind. So as a fan, it gets very frustrating. I mentioned Batista. He annihilated Del Rio, laid him out with a Batista bomb through the announce table. See, that's the Batista I remember. This was the closest thing to the old Batista that I think that we've gotten since he came back. Although I have even less interest in seeing their pay-per-view match now, which was officially announced by Triple H in the back after this segment aired. It's like, he just killed the dude with his move. He got his revenge. What's the point of even making the match now? But he needs something to do between now and WrestleMania, so that's what they've given him. Lita was announced as the next inductee into the WWE Hall of Fame, class of 2014. She joins Jake the Snake Roberts and the Ultimate Warrior. Trish Stratus went in last year. Only makes sense for Lita to go in, Trish's greatest rival. I assume Trish will be the one to do the induction. They haven't announced that yet. Unless they want to get Matt Hardy to do it. That'd be fun. Lita and Trish main evented an episode of Raw for the women's title back in 2004, which would be unheard of today with the way they treat the Divas division. Can you imagine putting, you know, Oksana against Cameron as the Raw main event 1 week? Yeah, that's just how things are with the Divas division these days. I don't want to hear the Divas can draw. The Divas could draw with the right women and the right story. And Trish and Lita were proof of that back in the day. And that wasn't her first main event either. Lita and Stephanie McMahon, I think, were the first women to ever headline an episode of Monday Night Raw back in 2000. Both times, Lita won the women's championship. That fact alone should probably earn her a spot in the Hall of Fame. And at age 38, I think she ties for the youngest Hall of Fame inductee, ironically, with Trish and with Edge, who also was 38 when he was put into the Hall of Fame. We found out this week that the ceremony is going to be airing live in its entirety on the WWE Network, so no more waiting for the edited version on DVD. Unless you live outside the U.S. and you don't get the network until next year, then you're shit out of luck. I've got more Hall of Fame news in a minute when we're done here with the Raw review. The New Age Outlaws were out for commentary during a match with Rybacksel and the Usos, which the Usos won. They made it clear here that the Usos were in line for a tag team title match. Maybe as early as Elimination Chamber, they could still add that match to the pay-per-view. I'm totally fine with that. The Usos are overdue for a tag team title win. You know, part of the reason I had no problem with them putting the belts on the Outlaws was because I figured they would have them drop the belts to the Usos maybe at WrestleMania, or maybe do some sort of four-way and the Usos would go over. If they want to do the match sooner, that's fine, but so long as they get the belts. You know, if the New Age Outlaws beat the Usos, then I have a big problem with it, but I doubt very seriously that that's going to happen. Divas stopwatch this week, 4 minutes 41 seconds. Cameron and the Bellas beat AJ, Oksana, and Alicia Fox. Cameron got the pin with her DDT, I guess they're calling it Bye Girl. That's what she calls it, Bye Girl. I assume that's a total Divas thing. She did pull out a tilt-a-whirl head scissors, which was impressive. Maybe the most impressive thing I've ever seen her do. Other than that, she did not look very good in there. It looks like she may end up getting Naomi's spot, which really sucks. I feel bad for Naomi. I said last week that I saw them doing Naomi and AJ at Elimination Chamber. But then I read the plan for WrestleMania was, and maybe it still is, for Naomi and AJ to wrestle for the championship and for Naomi to go over and win the belt. And now it looks like she may need surgery on her orbital bone, the injury when Oksana dropped her knee on her eye socket. And if that's the case, I don't know that she makes it back in time for WrestleMania, you know, unless she wears a mask like The Undertaker did back in 95 when Mabel crushed his orbital socket. Mabel was a little clumsy and did legit hurt The Undertaker. Undertaker, instead of taking time off, he came back with this Phantom of the Opera-looking mask. He looked ridiculous, but you know, at least he could wrestle with it. Shit, give her Undertaker's old Phantom of the Opera mask. Why not? Actually, that mask is probably bigger than her whole head. I do feel bad for her. You know, her match gets bumped off WrestleMania last year, and now this. So, we'll see. We'll see if she actually has the surgery or if she's going to be able to come back sooner. Main event was John Cena and Randy Orton. I wonder how many times I've said those words on this show since 2007. Somebody go back and check. Be very curious to see. what more is there really to say? You know, they had a match. It was the same match I saw them have at Madison Square Garden 2 months ago, kicking out of each other's finishes at the end and everything. That match was really good. This one was good, too. I just didn't care. I just don't care about John Cena and Randy Orton. Cena won with the AA, you know, yawn, gag, snore. I did love the announcers talking about how this match closes out their rivalry. Like, this was some definitive end to their decades-long feud, and they did this all while promoting the match that they're both in at the pay-per-view, which I thought was hilarious. It's like they're shaking your hand and kicking you in the crotch at the same time, you know? So it'll be Orton versus Sheamus this Monday in Denver, and if you remember, that was the match that the fans crapped all over the night after WrestleMania last year. That was the match that made New Jersey famous, Sheamus versus Orton. We'll see if history repeats itself. I think they'll be okay. Like I said earlier, Sheamus is way more over now than he was back then. He was big time over with the LA crowd last Monday, so I think it'll be okay, but, you know, that's all part of the fun, I guess, right? You never know what you're going to get. We've got some more WWE Hall of Fame notes. The belief is that the next man to be announced for the class of 2014 will be this Monday, and it will likely be Scott Hall. Now, if you're listening to this on Tuesday and it wasn't Scott Hall or they didn't make the announcement, then shame on me, I guess, for jumping the gun. But Hall was teasing it big time on his Twitter account this weekend. He's denying it now, but he pointed out that he, Lita, Jake Roberts, and Ultimate Warrior were all verified on Twitter at the same time. And WWE does get certain people verified with Twitter when they want to. I guess that's what happens when you have a million-dollar deal with Twitter. You can get people verified. Maybe they can get me verified. Plus, you know, Hall's name has been bounced around for a while. Him and Jake both were, given how well they seem to be doing these days, and the belief that, look, you never know what tomorrow is going to bring. There's no guarantee these guys won't fall off the wagon, right? Or come on hard times again. Let's put them in now while they seem to be doing okay and we have the chance. And also, Hall is one of Triple H's click buddies, and if the last few weeks prove anything at all, with Batista winning the Rumble, the Outlaws winning the tag team belts, Kevin Nash getting another Rumble payoff, it's that it pays to be friends with Triple H. In this case, I don't mind it, though, because Scott Hall is more than deserving of being in the Hall of Fame for what he's done in wrestling. I'm sure Kevin Nash will have his day, too, at some point. And say what you want to about the guy, he deserves a spot also. Hall and Nash, I mean, you can't deny the impact these guys had on wrestling, whether you like them or not. It's just something that you can't deny, that they had a positive impact at one point on business, and then in other cases, for better or worse, they certainly, you know, impacted WCW, they impacted WWE by jumping over to WCW, and there was a huge business turnaround, and it really was sparked when Hall made that first appearance on Nitro and they started the NWO angle. The NWO angle, before they drove it into the ground and they added everybody and their mother, literally, I think Judy Bagwell probably was in the NWO at some point. If she wasn't, could have fooled me, because that whole period is like a blur. Before that happened, though, the NWO, look, it's hard to argue that it wasn't the most successful kind of takeover or invasion angle or storyline that's ever been done in wrestling, at least here in this country. I can't speak for Mexico or Japan. And Eric Bischoff got the idea for the original NWO from something he saw being done in Japan back in 95. So it wasn't even an original idea, but it worked. He took that idea, he came up with other aspects of how it was going to work, and it paid off. And that original NWO was hot, man. It was hot. It turned business around for WCW, it made WWE work that much harder. It sparked the Monday Night Wars. And Scott Hall and Kevin Nash both played a huge role in that. And even if you take the NWO out of the picture, you know, you go back and Hall had a very nice career for himself. He got a start, his start in the NWA. He went over to the AWA, WCW, went to WWE, where he became a big-time superstar. And it's weird, if you look back, not a lot of guys back then in the early 90s when they would air vignettes and they would make their debut, you can't really think of too many guys who were rocketed to the top as fast as Scott Hall was. I guess around that same period of time, Yokozuna made his debut. He was champion within a few months. But when Razor Ramon debuted, he was already headlining pay-per-views. You know, he was in one of the double main events of Survivor Series in 92, teaming with Ric Flair against Randy Savage and Mr. Perfect. And Ramon was feuding with Savage there for a while. He headlined the Royal Rumble pay-per-view in 93. He wasn't in the Rumble match, but he challenged Bret Hart for the championship with a bad knee he had at the time, and they still had a pretty good match. And then after that, he kind of settled into, you know, the intercontinental level. He turned babyface several months later and took off. So he wasn't what I would call a main event headliner for much of his run there, but he got a hot start. He was on top at first. First person ever to four-peat as the Intercontinental Champion. The ladder matches with HBK, I say plural because I still think that SummerSlam 95 ladder match is underrated. People always think about WrestleMania 10, and that was a great match, but him and Shawn had two really great ladder matches, and Shawn is great, but, you know, it takes two to tango. Razor was in there, too. He played his role perfectly, so he was part of some really great matches in his time, and then went to WCW, the NWO stuff, and pretty much after that, it was, you know, it was downhill. You know, after the initial success with the NWO, Scott Hall became more of a punchline because of his issues with alcohol. I never heard stories of him being like a drug addict. It was always booze with him, and he just couldn't handle it. And they even incorporated it into a storyline at one time in WCW, which I thought was kind of tasteless. They had him coming out with, you know, alcohol in his hand with liquor. He was stumbling around, and I don't know. There's just certain boundaries I think you don't cross. That one hit a little too close to home. It would be one thing if the guy had substance abuse issues and had conquered them and by all accounts was doing well, and it's like, okay, why don't we try to play off that, you know, make it a little more realistic since a lot of people know about these issues. The guy was still going through booze problems, though. When you do a storyline like that, it's kind of fucked up. So, yeah, it was all downhill for him after that. He did have a run in WWE, very brief in 2002, a very forgettable feud with Steve Austin, and he was gone relatively quickly after that. I'm sure most people probably figured he would be. And he and Jake were both guys who a lot of people wrote off, and myself included. You know, I even said it on my show a long time ago. I didn't think those guys, especially Jake, were going to live another 5 years. I thought they'd be dead. There were people who had Deadpools going, figuring that, okay, which one's going to go first? And we weren't wrong to think that, because every week, every month, it seemed like there was a new incident that you would read about. Scott Hall got arrested for this. He groped this person, or he did this, or he did that. And Jake, I mean, my God, you could find footage of him at some of these independent shows on YouTube. You could see it with your own two eyes. It was pathetic, you know. But you look at the work that Diamond Dallas Page has done with both Scott Hall and Jake Roberts. He's a miracle man, DDP is. Helped them turn their lives around. You can't just say it was DDP who changed their lives. These guys had to want to change their own lives, you know, so they're every bit as responsible. But I think it's safe to say that without DDP's intervention, there's a pretty good chance one or both of those guys would not have been around to even see themselves be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Especially Scott Hall, who was really in a bad place when DDP called him up. The only reason he even called him was because he got a panicked phone call from Sean Waltman, who thought that Scott was near death. So DDP called him. He said, listen, bro, come on down, move in with me. He did. And the turnaround has been remarkable. And I said this on Twitter, I think DDP deserves a Hall of Fame nod too. And not just because, oh, he's a nice guy, he helped save these guys' lives. He actually had a pretty amazing career in WCW when you really stop and think about what he was able to accomplish. Three-time world champion, when nobody ever thought he would even sniff a world title in wrestling. Had a tryout as an announcer for WWE in the early 90s and got rejected. Then he became a manager. Didn't even get over in wrestling until he was 40 years old. And when I say he got over, he got himself over. He improved in the ring. He started having good matches. The fans were getting behind him. His finish, the Diamond Cutter, was a big part of that success, the same way the Stunner was for Steve Austin. You could hit that thing from anywhere. You know, I still say he gave Goldberg the best wrestling match of his career that one year at Halloween Havoc. He had his run in WWE, which wasn't as successful, but he still won a tag title. He won the European title before he left. I know he had some injuries at the time. He wrestled a little bit after that in TNA, but was pretty much done as an active wrestler. And now he's built a new career for himself with the DDP yoga stuff. He does motivational speaking. So when you look at his body of work and the way he got himself over at a late age when nobody ever thought he could, the success that he's had and now the impact that he's having on these other wrestlers, his brothers as he calls them, that's a Hall of Fame worthy career to me, not just because of the good stuff he's doing now. Look at his wrestling career. How can he not be considered Hall of Fame worthy when you look at some of the other people that WWE has inducted? You know, and there's no voting process for the WWE Hall of Fame like they have in baseball or the NFL or even the Observer Hall of Fame that I talked about last week, which is actually voted on by the wrestlers themselves. That's probably the most legit wrestling Hall of Fame there is. You know, with WWE, it's all up to the mind of a madman. But as a fan, if I try to look at this Hall of Fame as being even semi-legit, I mean, let's be honest here. Some of the people they've put in there don't belong in there. DDP would not be one of those people. I hope he gets in at some point. Let Jake, and if he goes in, let Scott Hall have their moments. I don't know that I would put them all in. I thought it would be kind of cool to put all three in, but I think that might be a little too much. It might be better to wait, you know, do the DDP induction next year and maybe have Scott and Jake, if they're still doing well, both induct him together. You know, I think that would be a cool moment. So Scott Hall, definitely worthy. Jake, I don't think there's any dispute that he belongs in the Hall of Fame. And for the people who maybe are on the fence or don't think that being a good guy makes him Hall of Fame worthy, you're being ignorant. Look at the body of his wrestling career. DDP also deserves a spot in the Hall of Fame. Before we move on here, there was also some WWE films news this week. Two new movies that WWE is going to be working on in the coming months. This is unbelievable. One of the movies is The Marine 4, on the heels of The Miz being in The Marine 3. Apparently it did better than expected in terms of DVD sales. So they're bringing The Miz back. The Miz becomes the first man to reprise the role as The Marine. John Cena did one movie. Ted DiBiase, remember him? He did one movie. The Miz did the last one. So they're bringing him back for part four. Summer Rae is also going to have a role in this movie. So just goes to what I'm saying. Summer Rae is going to be big down the road. She's getting better every week. Clearly they see something in her. She becomes, I think, the first diva to be in a WWE film. So I don't know what role she'll play, if she'll be his love interest. I don't know. But that movie is coming out. The other movie that they're going to be working on is a sequel to the Arnold Schwarzenegger film Jingle All the Way. Jingle All the Way 2 is going to be a WWE film. It's going to star Larry the Cable Guy and Santino Marella. Talk about a combo. Larry the Cable Guy and Santino Marella in Jingle All the Way 2. I could not make this shit up if I tried. I liked Jingle All the Way. I don't care what anybody says. That movie is a guilty pleasure of mine. You know, Arnold talking about Turbo Man. Sinbad was in that movie. Phil Hartman, who's no longer around, he was in that movie. It was so corny, the whole Turbo Man, you know, storyline in the movie and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know. There was something about it that I liked. Every time Christmas rolls around, it pops up on cable. If I come across it, it's one of those movies I have to stop and watch. Call me crazy. But part two with these two guys, I don't know. I don't know about that one. They're doing the Leprechaun movie. That one's coming out, I think, in October or November. Kane, See No Evil 2 is also coming out later this year. So, yeah, they're starting to take some of these franchises and breathe new life into them. You know, like the Leprechaun one, I'm morbidly curious to check that one out with Hornswoggle playing the Leprechaun, because that's what he is. Even this one, I guess I'm morbidly curious to see how it turns out. I'm just trying to think of other movies, if you could call it bad movies, that they could take and kind of breathe new life into. I have to give that some thought. Maybe we could do like a list. What other bad movies do you think WWE could kind of buy the rights to and reprise them with some of their own talent? Send me some of your suggestions. Maybe I'll read them on the Sound Off. NXT. We are now about a week and a half away from the live NXT Arrival special on the WWE Network. Very excited for that show. Renee Young joined Tom Phillips, Alex Riley, and William Regal. Sir Regal back on commentary. She joined them for the opening Divas match, which saw Emma, Bayley, and Natalya beat Alicia Fox, Sasha Banks, and Summer Rae when Alicia tapped to the Emma Lock. Regal and Renee, they just have to get a room already. Every week, they're always flirting with each other. I don't blame him. I'm just saying, you know, he's a married man. Come on. Can't be doing that. Regal also made a comment during this match when Alicia Fox was on offense. He said that she may be the best pure wrestler in the Divas division on the entire roster, which sounded a bit suspect to me with Natalya standing not 5 feet away from her on the apron. I've seen her nearly kill a few women with that axe kick that she does. It was also weird to hear him say that in a week where Alicia Fox had a match with Eva Marie that was so awesome, it got edited off the SmackDown airing on Friday night. Although I'm sure that had more to do with Eva Marie than Alicia Fox. Think of all the talented guys that WWE has signed from the indies and how long they've been stuck in developmental before getting brought up to the main roster, and then consider that Eva Marie went straight to the main roster. Life is not fair sometimes, and that is a perfect example of it. I enjoyed this match. I am liking Summer Rae more and more every week. I said it before. She's going to be the next big star of the Divas division at some point. At one point when Bayley was in trouble, she was trying to reach for a tag. Summer Rae was in there with her. Summer just sits down, Indian style, right in front of her, between Bayley and her partners. She just sits down, stares right at her, starts mocking her. It's such a subtle thing, but I thought to myself, you know, I don't think I've ever actually seen a male wrestler do that before. You know, just to be a dick or something. I've never seen it. But it works for Summer Rae because her character is a bitch and a bully. Emma also, very good here. Her debut on the main roster so far has been a bust. It's only been 2 weeks. But they say you only have a first chance, one chance, right, to make a good first impression. She has not made the best first impression, and it's not her fault. It really is not her fault. It's just they bring her up to the main roster, and that's what they do with her. Really? That's the best you could come up with for this girl? Just throwing her out there as a comedy character with Santino? Again, there's more to her than just the stupid dance. But wouldn't shock me if you know, they show Vince McMahon a video of her and he's like, oh, ho, 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 that dance is funny. Let's put her out there with Santino. Yes, but Vince, she can wrestle. What? What is this wrestle that you speak of? You're fired. I imagine that's probably not too far off from what actually happens, but I don't know. They need to transition her away from that as quickly as possible and let her get a few matches under her belt. Aiden English beat Colin Cassidy with his director's cut finish, which looks terrible when he does it to a big guy. Cassidy's like 7 feet, maybe a little less. And it's just one of those moves that doesn't look good if you're a smaller guy doing it to a big guy. It just doesn't look believable. But he pinned him fair and square, clean as a sheet, no Enzo. It was just the two of them out there. Then came the best segment on the entire show. Sami Zayn came to the ring without crutches. He was still limping a little bit from his knee injury. He is still tortured by that 2 out of 3 falls lost to Antonio Cesaro last year. It still bothers him that he lost that match. Somebody should tell him that wins and losses don't matter in WWE. Then he wouldn't worry so much. And ever since, he's been trying to figure out that one thing in that match that went wrong. What was the one mistake that he made? Cue Cesaro, who comes out in a suit. He says, the problem, Sammy, is that you're too busy searching for that one thing. There is no one thing. I'm just better than you. And without mentioning Ring of Honor or any of the indies that they've wrestled in, Sami Zayn talked about their history together of wrestling one another all over the world, and he says he respects Cesaro. It was very muted, but you could hear Cesaro say, you should, which was kind of funny. There was also a point here where Cesaro told the crowd to quiet down for a second, and they did. Even the crowd at Full Sail respects Cesaro. Cesaro wants to know if Sammy's knee is okay. Is your knee 100%? He says it's fine. He wants Cesaro to give him one more match. The crowd then starts a pinky swear chant. I don't know where the hell that came from. And even more awesome, the two of them obliged, and they gave it to them. They did a pinky swear. I think the first time I've ever even heard of a pinky swear was probably on Full House. I'm not afraid to admit that I did watch that show when I was younger. So Cesaro reminds us all that he's a freaking great heel when he tells Sami Zayn, "My answer is still no." And he kicks him in the knee. He kicks him in his bad knee, and he walks off. Brilliant. Brilliant stuff. As he's leaving, Triple H graces us with his presence and says, in fact, Cesaro will wrestle Sami Zayn February 27th on the WWE Network. And the fans chant, "Best for business," and I could not agree more. See, now, if Cesaro just can win the WWE title somehow at Elimination Chamber, he can defend it against Sami Zayn here on NXT. What a debut that would be for the guy, wrestling for the World Heavyweight title. We had CJ Parker against Ty Dillinger, who, for those of you who may not know, is the former Sean Spears, or Gavin Spears, I guess his name was, when he was in their version of ECW. A nothing match. Parker put him away with the third eye, palm thrust. After the match, he cut a promo turning heel on all the fans. He says, you know, if they don't love him, he don't love them. Apparently, he's also a vegan and an environmentalist, which in WWE automatically makes you a heel. And a nerd, if you're Daniel Bryan. If you're an aspiring wrestler, a word of advice: Vince McMahon loves his men to be tall, jacked up, gas-guzzling carnivores. Just remember that. Main event was kind of odd. It was the return to NXT of the Wyatt family, who have not appeared on the show in many months. And by the end of their run, they were total babyfaces at Full Sail. Fans loved them. Here, Bray Wyatt sat in his rocking chair while Harper and Rowan beat the snot out of two guys whose names I didn't get. Harper finished one of them off with a vicious lariat. Bray got into the ring, laid one of them out with Sister Abigail. They stacked the other guy on top of him. Bray cut a promo saying how they never forget where they came from. Big pop for that. Fade to black, and we're out. So, a weird finish. More like an old school episode of Superstars or Wrestling Challenge, where there didn't need to be a reason for the show to go off the air the way that it did. I'm not saying this wasn't good. I just don't know what the purpose was. If it was to build up their feud with The Shield, you know, if they're saying, unlike The Shield, we don't forget where we came from, I get that. But they taped these shows weeks ago, so I really don't think they even knew that was the direction they were going in at that time. But they came off as total stars here, which was very cool to see. So, a good show. There haven't really been a string of what I would call great NXT shows in many weeks, but I just get the impression they're kind of in a holding pattern almost until this live special on the 27th, which, again, I am very much looking forward to, maybe even more than the pay-per-view coming up next weekend. So if ever there was a reason to spend $9.99 on the WWE Network, if I had to give an endorsement, I would endorse it just so you can watch the NXT special on the 27th. I think it's going to be that good. And I see that WWE.com just posted an update. Just to go back to what I was talking about earlier during the Raw review with Naomi, there is an injury update on Naomi that we can share here. She will be out of action for 4 to 6 weeks, according to the story on WWE.com. The physician there said that she will not have to undergo surgery for the fracture, as neither, I guess, her eye or any nerves are caught in the orbital fracture. But she needs time to heal. She cannot travel by plane due to, I guess, the pressures involved with flying. So 4 to 6 weeks would put them before WrestleMania, but not really. It's cutting it close. So I don't know that she's going to be able to go at WrestleMania. Maybe they do some sort of multi-women match, and if she's all healed up, they can stick her in there, and maybe she could still win the belt. 4 to 6 weeks is assuming that there's no issues. 4 to 6 weeks assumes that at the end of that 6 weeks, max, she'll be ready to go, and you just don't know. So that's cutting it real close. I don't really think that clears anything up as far as her WrestleMania status, but at least she won't have to have surgery. That's a positive. So that's the update on Naomi. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book. Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/Solomonster. It's another way to show your support for the Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Solomonster. TNA Impact this week was in Manchester, UK. Really, really liked Impact this week. I know, I had to pinch myself to see if I was dreaming. It moved along at a good pace. There was a little less Dixie than usual. Not much. A little bit. And some good action. So the show opened with Delusional Dixie and her gang in the ring. They get interrupted by MVP and Samoa Joe. MVP has announced that Samoa Joe will get Magnus for the title at Lockdown, so that's your Lockdown main event. This brought out Gunner, who says he's tired of lugging his Feast or Fired briefcase around. He's giving Magnus 7 days to get ready, and then he's cashing in on Impact this upcoming Thursday. Dixie counters this by saying Gunner will put his briefcase on the line against her nephew, EC3. MVP referred to him as C3PO, which I thought was funny. He said, you know what? I'll do you one better. How about we do EC3 and Gunner tonight, but it'll be a ladder match. And Gunner's briefcase and EC3's briefcase, remember EC3 has a tag team title shot in his briefcase, both briefcases will be hanging above the ring, winner take all. So we have EC3 and Gunner. They go for a few minutes. Their ladder match goes to a no contest. First time, I think, maybe in history that a ladder match has gone to a no contest. Magnus ran in. James Storm eventually ran in. The only thing missing here was Teddy Long. MVP played the role of Teddy Long. He came out, turned it into a tag team match. Playa, winner take all ladder match, which Storm and Gunner won. Gunner was yanking on the cable that was holding up both briefcases while he was falling off the ladder, and it was, I didn't know what was going to happen. I figured the briefcases would just snap off and he would fall to the ground, but it didn't happen that way. Instead, what happened is, whatever the chain or the cable that they were attached to, he just pulled the whole thing down. He was basically standing on his own 2 feet on the mat, and he was still holding on to the cable. Finally, he unhooked them, so that could have been a disaster. Could have pulled the whole thing down. This was a good match, though. Some cool spots here. They did a spot where Magnus had Gunner. He was kind of sprawled out across the ladder. Magnus was holding up one end, and the other end was resting on the middle rope. And off the top rope came EC3 with a splash. EC3, I gotta say, you know, he really impressed me in this match. He took some bumps, some pretty hellacious bumps on that ladder. More than held his own in there. He looked like a star. The first time I can honestly say I've watched this guy on Impact in the ring, and he's come off as anything even resembling a star. And I took notice of him here. He was competitive. He wasn't some scrub, you know, running away from his opponent. He was taking it to Gunner. He was taking it to Storm. Clearly, they're building to something with him and Magnus, because EC3 at one point had the match won. He was ready to climb and grab the briefcases, and instead, Magnus yanked him off and said, you know what, I'm going to climb up. So I guess he didn't want EC3 getting a shot at his title, which makes sense. They really worked over Gunner's ribs with the ladder. If I had one small criticism of the match here, you would never know that they were brutalizing this guy's ribcage for the whole match. Even after the match, you know, Gunner, when he climbed the ladder to win and then he was celebrating and everything else, it's almost like he forgot to sell. A good part of the match was them working over his ribs, and it was pretty brutal stuff. You know, they were hitting him with the ladder. Like I said, EC3 splashed him across the ladder right on his ribs. You would never know it when the match was over. So, a minor point, I liked the match. Gunner gets his world title match next week on Impact. I'd watch out for the Cowboy if I'm Gunner. That's all I'm going to say. Backstage, we had a very brief segment with Mr. Anderson talking about his casket match with Bully Ray. He said the match is not about a cut, you know, like some vest. It's not about motorcycles. It's not about championships. It's about family. And he held up a photo on his iPhone of his new twins. Probably the most likable that Anderson has ever been to me. I could get behind him here because they made him human. You know, they made this thing with him and Bully personal. He wasn't out there being his usual obnoxious self. And it's one thing to be obnoxious as a heel. When he's obnoxious as a babyface, that really pisses me off. It's kind of like The Miz. But I was totally behind him here. I was a fan of Anderson on this show. This was good stuff. The Wolves, Eddie Edwards and Davey Richards, made their in-ring TNA debut. They teamed up with Samoa Joe against the Bromans and DJ Zema Ion. Lots of tandem offense here from the Wolves. A real tag team. It was very refreshing to see them pulling off some actual tag team moves. Joe was over like crazy in Manchester. It's too bad it took a bunch of guys leaving the company for them to get behind the guy. He's been there so long, but better late than never. He's the kind of guy that you could build your company around. I shared that story from one of the newsletters last week of on one of the bus trips overseas. They were going from one city to the next, and Joe gave this really inspirational, like motivational speech, this big pep talk to everybody. And it really pumped them all up, and they were on the bus chanting, Joe, Joe, Joe. You know, he comes off to me, when you hear stories like that, as a guy who can be a locker room leader. And he's also the kind of guy who, you know, like I said, you can build your company around, and that he's good on the mic, and he's believable as a badass in the ring. So hopefully this isn't just a situation where they're plugging him in as the next challenger, he gets beaten and demoted, and they're just waiting for Kurt Angle to come back or for Jeff Hardy to come back, which he is. Hopefully this is the sign that they finally realize what they've got in this guy and they can try to get him back to a point that he was at 6-7 years ago, you know, where people are willing maybe to pay money to see him wrestle in a pay-per-view main event. And I mean, I don't know that anything will ever be able to spike their ratings, but build around Joe, build around a guy like Aries. Like that's what they need to start doing. And he choked out Zema for the win. Velvet Sky went to Delusional Dixie, who was backstage with MVP. She begged her to call off her match with Chris Sabin. She refused, sent Velvet on her way. They did this deal where Dixie and MVP shared an office backstage, and she had a yellow dividing line right down the middle to make it very clear that MVP was to stay on his side. So, very mature. She said she wished MVP was still a wrestler so that somebody could kick his ass. Rockstar Spud started mocking MVP, mentioned his previous stint in prison. Probably not a good idea to mock somebody who spent time behind bars, especially if you're somebody who's about 105 pounds soaking wet. MVP said, you know, I just happen to have my gear with me. And he challenged Spud to a match tonight. They had their match a little bit later. MVP beat him in about a minute. He did do his ballin' elbow drop, for those of you who were interested. Apparently that's still a thing. Abyss and Eric Young had a segment out in the ring. Abyss unmasked himself again. Actually, I don't even think he was wearing the mask. I think he had the hood over his face. Pulled the hood down. You could clearly see it's Joseph Park. So that storyline is dead once and for all. I'm going to miss that guy. I really am. I'm going to miss Joe Park. I love the fire that Abyss showed during this segment. He was on his A-game here. Eric Young came out. He got all up in his face. He blamed Eric Young for everything that's happened. He said, you know, I've ruined people's lives. I've carved up my own body. Look at the scars on my arms. I just can't do this anymore. He said he has to go away for a while. He has to find somebody who truly understands him and can help him fix this, whatever this is. It certainly seemed to me like he was teasing the return of Father James Mitchell, the former sinister minister back in the old ECW, and his original manager in TNA, and a man who absolutely should have been picked up by WWE. When ECW went out of business, or even after TNA let him go, and I don't know why they ever let him go either, I just don't understand how a guy like that, he looks evil. I mean, can you imagine if that guy, the way he looks, was born that way? Looking at that baby coming out of your womb, if I'm that woman, I mean, I want to shove that thing right back in there. That guy looked evil from day one, the first time I ever saw him. He's the kind of guy you would cast in a movie about somebody evil. He could play the role of Lucifer in a movie. He's a natural for something like that. He was very good in that role. And why WWE never thought to pick him up, I don't get it. I just don't understand it. I guess maybe now we have some more managers in WWE. Back then, they were getting away from the manager thing, and I ranted on that back in the day, too. I always thought that was a mistake for them to get away from managers. Vince McMahon probably thinking, oh, it's like an old wrestling thing, managers. Get the fuck out of here. I mean, managers have been important from day one in wrestling. And God knows they've pushed so many big guys that had no business even having a microphone in their hand. You would think that, if anything, they would want to put some of those guys with a person who could speak for them. So I always thought that that was a big mistake, and not picking up this guy, I think, was also a mistake. I think there was a time when I thought him as Kane's new manager, back when Kane was still masked, I think that could have worked. Maybe he isn't coming back here to TNA, and I'm just reading too much into it, but that was the name that popped into my head when Abyss said that. He dropped his mask at Eric Young's feet, and Abyss walked off to end the segment. Sam Shaw is still creeping out Christy Hemme. He offered to help her with her bags backstage, then said he agreed with her decision to keep things professional, shook her hand. As he turned away, it almost looked to me like he was holding his hand up to his nose to smell her hand. He didn't actually do it, although who am I to say? Maybe he did when he was off camera. The guy's a freak. We had the Willow vignette. This has been the subject of a lot of conversation. I've gotten a lot of questions about this. Willow the Wisp. Jeff Hardy's old gimmick going back to his days in Omega. I think he also played Willow once at a Ring of Honor show and got booed out of the building. The way they shot this was, it very much reminded me of those old early Wyatt family vignettes that WWE did. Whether that was their intent or not, I'm thinking it was. Why not? You know, the Wyatts are a hot act right now in WWE, and Bray Wyatt's character, you know, I'm big into it. I think he does a great job with it. It's a little creepy. So why not piggyback on that? I know, again, Willow as a character, Jeff Hardy was playing him many years ago, but that doesn't mean that, you know, they wouldn't shoot this kind of vignette back in the day. I'm sure the style and everything else, they probably were going for a Wyatt vibe. And like I said, I don't blame them. It looked interesting, I will say that. He reminded me of the guy from Jeepers Creepers for some reason. They don't exactly look alike, but that was just my initial thought when I saw Jeff in this commercial. I'm curious how they're going to handle this, because on their website, TNA already announced that Jeff Hardy is coming back at Lockdown next month. They didn't say on the website what he'll be doing. I think you could probably read spoilers somewhere and figure out what he'll actually be doing on that show. But they've announced that Jeff Hardy, not Willow, Jeff Hardy is coming back. So are they going to do a Joe Park Abyss deal where Hardy plays two characters, or is he going to come back as Willow? Makes no sense to announce his return and then have him play a totally new character. You know, that'd be like John Cena being gone with an injury and coming back 2 weeks later, which is about the average recovery time for a John Cena injury, and having him play the role of Juan Cena, you know, his Mexican brother coming back. So I'm guessing he'll be playing two different people. We'll see. Bobby Roode confronted Dixie Carter backstage, very upset. He wanted to know where his title shot was. Dixie said, "You don't have a title shot. You lost. You lost to Samoa Joe last week. That was your opportunity, and you blew it." And Roode was in no mood to hear that. He told her, "You do not want me as your enemy." And he walked off. I like this. I like Bobby Roode. I'm a fan of Bobby Roode. I thought this segment was good. There was very subtle thing here where you could hear somebody off camera, I guess a security guard maybe, saying something, and Dixie kind of waved him off and said, no, it's okay, because Roode was throwing things, and I don't know, just little things like that. I could appreciate that. Velvet Sky and Chris Sabin had their match. It was more of an angle. Chris Sabin, as the whiny heel, is awesome. I love Chris Sabin in this role. So much better than Chris Sabin when he was the babyface world champion. Just very boring and bland, and probably one of the worst world champions in wrestling history. If you made a top 10 list of the worst booked world champions of probably all time, or at least of the modern era, it's hard to argue that Sabin isn't up there like in the top three. Sabin, Rey Mysterio, I'd have to think of who else would be on that list. But in this role, I think he's great. He called Velvet a skank. This was actually really funny. She kicked him in his bad knee after he called her a skank. I guess they're both bad knees, but she kicked him in one of the knees, and he's like, "Why did you kick me in my knee?" And then immediately she kicks him in the crotch. Big reaction for that. Sabin just laughs it off and says, "You always were a no-talent piece of trash. I came prepared." And he reaches down into his crotch area. He pulls a cup out of his pants, starts waving it around. He's like, "See, stupid?" Turns around very proudly to display this cup to the crowd in Manchester. And Velvet immediately delivers another low blow And this time, Saban wasn't laughing. Yambag Yahtzee times two. That's what Taz said. That was great. So Velvet now, she mounts him. She starts pounding away on Saban. And suddenly, this large woman appears. They refer to her as an Amazon. She grabs Velvet, starts violently shaking her around like a rag doll in this full Nelson. Then she carries Saban around victoriously on her shoulders. This was basically China's debut from 1997, right down to calling her an Amazon and having her ragdoll Velvet, like China did to Marlena back in the day. It was a good angle. I liked it, but still, a total copy of the China stuff. And you know what? If they could get this woman over the way the WWE did with China, more power to them. But this is another one of those angles where I don't want to hear it from TNA fans who get so butthurt when they hear people saying, oh, you TNA stole this idea. They copied this idea from WWE. Because WWE's also taken some stuff from TNA before. But it's like they can't bring themselves to admit that there are certain angles like this one that are blatantly ripped off from old shit that WWE has done. And sometimes there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes it comes off as second-rate and pathetic. And sometimes it's okay. And I didn't mind that here. It was a strong angle, but so obviously ripped off from WWE, you know, 16 years ago. And hey, if they can make it work, like I said, more power to them. Backstage, Bully Ray found his way to Mr. Anderson's luggage. He left it unattended, and he pulled Anderson's iPhone out of the bag, dialed Anderson's wife. Why does Mr. Anderson not have a passcode on his iPhone? Protect your shit, people. He told her that this was the phone call that she had been dreading her entire life. He said he was sending her husband back home to the States in a coffin. And by the way, he said, tell the twins Daddy says goodbye. Backstage, Bobby Roode teased that he might leave TNA. He was very despondent. The interviewer was trying to get some answers out of him, and he wouldn't give him the answers he was looking for. He said he needs some time away to figure things out. And that's when security showed up and they escorted him out of the building. So he and Abyss both need time away to figure things out. There seems to be a pattern developing here with the TNA originals. Maybe that's code for them figuring out their exit strategy. Maybe that's what it is. Bully Ray and Mr. Anderson in a casket match. Bully revealed a Liverpool jersey, which got him a ton of heat with the Manchester fans. It's cheap heat, but what an awesome dick Bully Ray is. This was a good match, a good blow-off to their feud, if that's what it was. I hope it was. I see people ragging on TNA for the cheap-ass-looking casket that they used. It did look bad at the end when Anderson put Bully in the casket and he couldn't close the lid all the way, yet they rang the bell anyway. That did look kind of cheap, but I actually thought the casket was good, at least before the finish, because of how small it was. Now, like me, personally, I'm claustrophobic, so I don't like tight spaces. So the thought of being stuffed into a box that small is terrifying to me. Okay, in WWE, they buy these giant caskets. Not for nothing. Some of them are bigger than my apartment. It's like, yeah, put me in there. I don't mind. You could throw a TV in there and some snacks and be perfectly comfortable. I mean, shit, what's the rent? So they probably just couldn't afford a nicer one, just like they couldn't afford to get MVP to the arena in a limo that night he made his debut. He showed up in like an SUV or something. But in this case, I actually thought it worked. The casket is not meant to be comfortable. Okay, it's supposed to be cramped and scary, which this one was. Anderson got cut up somehow on his face. I think it was his mouth got busted open. So the blood just added to the match. It ended with Bully going to pile drive Anderson inside the casket. They had brought the casket into the ring. It was so lightweight and flimsy. It was almost like a table. They just kind of, at one point, shoved it into the ring, and the casket spent half the match inside the ring. So he went to pile drive him inside of it. Instead, Anderson reversed it, and he turned it into a mic check into the casket. And then as a nice added touch, Anderson grabbed the Liverpool shirt, threw that into the casket, which the crowd went crazy for, and put the lid on and won the match. So a good match, good finish, the best Anderson match I've seen in a long time. I had no problem with this at all. Would have been a perfect end to the show. Instead, they decided to end with another delusional Dixie segment. This I did not agree with. You could have easily put this on before the main event. You know, I feel like when you have a big match like the one between Anderson and Bully that they were promoting for weeks, and it's a gimmick match, it's a casket match, and you have a happy ending like they had here, you give people a happy finish like that, you go off the air with that. Instead, we had Dixie and MVP talking to end the show. More talking as the main event on Impact. She said her experience with wrestlers is that they are not very good businessmen. Pot meet kettle. She offered to buy out his shares in TNA, which he refused. Instead, he countered with the offer of a lethal lockdown match at the next pay-per-view with Dixie's four against MVP's team of four. Winner gets complete control over wrestling operations. So they're basing an entire pay-per-view main event around who gets the power in TNA. And I know I sound like a broken record with this, but who gives a flying fuck? Who is in power in TNA? Who gives a shit about who the GM is, or who has the power to make matches, or who's responsible for what catering is backstage? Nobody gives a shit. So I don't like that aspect of this whole thing. If it somehow results in Dixie being phased off television, which I don't think it will, then I will accept it. But I just don't like the idea that everything has to be built around this whole notion of who's in power. It just seems like, you know, every single year, every single administration, every single time there's a change in TNA, it's the same basic storyline concept. Who's in power? Who's going to finally be the person to turn things around and change TNA? After 12 years, they still have to have a storyline where things suck, and we need this new authority figure to come in and help fix the mess that was made by the person who was in charge previously. Who cares? Nobody cares. So Dixie refused that offer. Then a few seconds later, she seemingly accepted when MVP said that either she sees things his way or she's gone. How he suddenly is able to have that kind of power over her, that wasn't explained. This segment also looked like it was edited to shit. There were some weird jump cuts in there. Not surprising, given that this segment required Dixie to act. I'm sure they had to do a couple of different takes at least. So I guess the match is set. You know, would have been much better, though, to end with Anderson's win. I think that was a big mistake. I will not let that sour what I otherwise thought was a really good show, in spite of what I just said. Overall, a lot of the other segments, the stuff with Joe, even the Saban Velvet stuff, the Wolves making their debut, the Abyss segment, I really enjoyed it. I thought, especially compared to some of the recent episodes, this was probably, if not the strongest, one of the stronger episodes from the UK of Impact that they've done recently. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can also send me MP3 questions, attachments, and please include the text of your question in the email if you do that. And when you write in, please include your name and where you are from. Ross Shepherd from London, UK. What are the chances CM Punk has already resolved his issues with WWE, but both parties are keeping it quiet, leaving us to believe that there is still a stalemate between the two sides, and making his comeback in Chicago on March 3rd even more dramatic? Would Punk and WWE agree to turn this shoot into a work and leave Punk off television? Absolutely. Absolutely. It's definitely possible. I mean, you could come up with a lot of other examples of things that started out very real that turned into a work. I mean, I talked earlier, Lita's going into the Hall of Fame. That whole Edge, Lita, Matt Hardy thing, that was very real. Believe me, that was very real. And that turned into a storyline. Didn't work out too well for Matt Hardy. Worked out very well for Edge and Lita. But you can point to a lot of different examples over the years where that kind of stuff has happened. So if they reach a deal, if they've already reached a deal, yeah, I think March 3rd in Chicago would probably make sense to bring him back as a surprise on that show, get a big reaction, and start whatever storyline is going to be there for him for WrestleMania, whether it's Triple H or something else. You know, in fact, if I were them and I reached a deal, that's exactly what I would do. I would hold off until March 3rd and blow the roof off the place. Why throw him back on TV in the next couple of weeks? You know, they're loading up that Raw show next Monday in Green Bay. They're going to have, you know, The Undertaker will likely be on that show. Hulk Hogan will likely be on that show. I'm sure they're going to have, you know, maybe they'll announce like one big match maybe on Raw this week for that show. That's the night the network is going to launch. It makes no sense for Punk to come back that night. He'll, you know, his return may get lost in the shuffle. You've got this big show in his hometown in 2 weeks, and even then you still have a month to promote whatever he's going to do for WrestleMania, so absolutely I would do that. Kenneth from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I was recently listening to Eric Young on the Art of Wrestling podcast, and he said that he and Bobby Roode once had a dark match in WWE, and they were thinking of hiring them, but were told that it was easier just to hire an American. Do you think that if Bobby Roode went to WWE, he could have been something there, or even a future WWE champion? I don't know about WWE champion. I mean, it's impossible to know. He probably would have had a chance back when they had two belts. He could have been like a world heavyweight champion. But yeah, I mean, I think Bobby Roode could have been something. I still think Bobby Roode could be something. He's not an old man. You know, he's at the peak of his game right now. And his contract, I think, also may be coming up for expiration in the next year or so. And I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know if they're going to have a situation with him like they did with AJ Styles, where they have to negotiate a new deal and they want to pay him less, and maybe he decides to leave. WWE seemingly does not want anybody in TNA unless they're a big star like Sting. You know, that's just the mentality. And I think, again, I think that's a mistake. I think you can cherry pick a few guys here and there who could absolutely be great additions to your roster. Do they need Bobby Roode? No, they don't need anybody from TNA. They don't need AJ Styles. They don't need Sting. They don't need anybody. It's not a matter of needing somebody. There is no one person that they need. But collectively, there's a lot of really talented guys, I think, who could really tear it up in WWE, and Bobby Roode, I think, would fit right in there. I think he would do very well for himself. Brian in Arizona, I was watching a YouTube video titled Top 10 Saddest Moments in WWE. One of the clips they showed was when JBL gave Eddie Guerrero's mother a heart attack. I further researched this, and there is a lot of dispute that this was a work or a a lot of dispute about whether or not it was a work or a shoot. I'm curious if you know if this was real. No, it was not real. It was an angle. I think JBL even wrote a blog about it once on layfieldreport.com. And it was a great angle, too. You know, when I got this question from Brian, I went back and I looked up the video. There's one poor quality, like grainy video of it on YouTube. But it was an angle they did in 2004. This wasn't long after, it was a couple of months after Eddie won the belt and was transitioning into a feud with JBL. And they did an angle. They opened an episode of SmackDown with Michael Cole in the ring, very somberly saying that this past weekend at a live event, tragedy struck. Eddie Guerrero's mother suffered a heart attack, and we're going to show you very disturbing footage right now. And that right there, when they tell you this horrible thing occurred, and right now we're going to show you footage of what happened, okay? That right there is a telltale sign that it's a work. Obviously, I guess they did a very good job of convincing people otherwise. I never one second even thought it was anything other than an angle. If you watch the footage, it's plain as day. It was a really good angle, though. You know, and what I like about that whole thing was that they opened one of their TV shows by showing footage of an angle that happened at a house show. And I really think that they need to do that more often. You never see them really acknowledging anything like that that has happened at a live event, whether it's a title change or anything like that. I think just to promote ticket sales, you should do that more often. And not just say, oh, such and such a thing happened at the live event this weekend. Shoot some footage. They have cameras at all these shows. Shoot some footage. Air it on TV. Let people know what they're missing. Kim from Dallas, if you could work around the breakup of the Shield and fix the cracks to keep them together as a long-lasting trio, how would you book it? And in the actual world, what would you do with Seth Rollins after the Shield, since it seems to be revolving mostly around Dean and Roman? I see Rollins as somebody who could settle in nicely at an intercontinental level, like the Intercontinental Champion, probably as a heel, although I think long-term, I think he could be much bigger as a babyface. He's not going to get anywhere as a babyface right now. There's just no room for him. So I think you break him up, you give him a push as a heel, maybe as the Intercontinental Champion, U.S. Champion, whatever. I would unify those belts, but and just prove that the guy can stand on his own two feet, let that go on for a while, and then when the time is right, you could turn him. I think that's probably what I would do with Rollins. As far as how to keep the Shield together, I'd keep booking it as they are. You know, keep building to a split very slowly. Do the slow burn, mainly between Dean and Roman, with Seth kind of caught in the middle, but then have them swerve everybody in the end. That would be the way to go. Instead of just having them randomly patch up their differences on TV and pretending like all this dissension never happened, you know, take a page out of the Horseman playbook from many years ago. When Ric Flair was at odds with the Horsemen, he enlisted the help of his hated rival Sting to fight them. And then in the end, of course, Flair turned on Sting, and the Horsemen were united. That's if they were to keep them together. That's how I would do it. Roman Reigns, though, is going to be huge as a babyface on his own. So I hate the idea of breaking up the Shield, but you kind of have to do it. You know, it just makes sense to do it and let these guys branch off, do their own thing. And a few years down the road, wouldn't surprise me at all if some combination of these three guys were on top in WWE feuding with each other one-on-one. Fabian writes in, I was recently going through the previous WrestleMania buy rates and noticed that WrestleMania 19 came in under 600,000 buys. With that being said, what happened? Why do you assume the buy rate was so low? The card was loaded with Hogan, Austin, Rock, Lesnar, HBK, and many more. That's one of the great mysteries. I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that question. If you look at the list of WrestleMania buy rates from that time, it really does stand out. You look at WrestleMania 17, that did, I think WrestleMania 17 was like 925,000 buys, some ridiculous number. And that was just domestically. That wasn't even, I don't think that was a combined number. I'm pretty sure that was just domestically, which is huge. And that was the peak of the Attitude Era. WrestleMania 18 also did very well. And then 19, it's like it fell off a cliff. 20, I think it was back up. 21 did over a million buys. So 19 is just kind of sitting there in the middle. It's like, what the hell happened here? And you're right. You look at the card. They had Hogan versus McMahon. They had Austin versus Rock in what turned out to be their final match. They had Kurt Angle, Brock Lesnar in the main event. They had Shawn Michaels making his comeback at WrestleMania, his first WrestleMania match in like 4 years against Chris Jericho. And they had a bunch of other guys in the show. Undertaker that year had a throwaway match. That was the worst Undertaker WrestleMania match, I don't want to say ever, because Undertaker did have a match with Giant Gonzalez once. But it was certainly, I think, of the last like 10 or 15, 20 years, you know, probably the worst. It was terrible. It was supposed to be a tag team match. Nathan Jones was so awful that they actually removed him from the match and turned it into a handicap match. It was Undertaker against Big Show and A-Train. So the idea of the Undertaker at WrestleMania with the streak, and the streak wasn't as big back then as it was now, but it was already being acknowledged that he had the streak going, and you put him in a handicap match, you do that on Raw. You don't do that at WrestleMania. It was terrible, but he was on the show. Matt Hardy, I think, opened that show for the Cruiserweight belt against Rey Mysterio. There was some tag match involving, I think, Eddie and Benoit as a team against Haas and Benjamin. And I mean, there were a lot of good matches on that show. Maybe people just didn't buy into Hogan versus McMahon. They built that pay-per-view around Hogan McMahon as the main event. Now, the match didn't go on last, but that was positioned as the main event. So maybe people didn't want to see two old guys going at it. Maybe that had something to do with it. That was also the show where Triple H, you know, we won't get into that again, the whole Triple H Booker T debacle. That was the end of Booker T as a world title contender for a few years. Let's leave it at that. Lastly, Ravon Adamson, now that Over the Edge 1999 is airing on the WWE Network, how do you think Bret Hart feels about it? Do you think he is for the idea or against the idea? I'll be honest with you, I really don't care what Bret Hart thinks about it. It's not his call. It's not like they're showing Owen falling 80 feet from the ceiling, so I imagine that Bret will be fine with it. You know, I doubt he's going to watch it. I'm not watching it either, but if they want to air it, let them air it. What Bret Hart thinks or what Martha Hart thinks or whoever, it makes no difference. It doesn't matter. History has been made here! This week in wrestling history, we go back 30 years ago this week on February 10th, 1984. David Von Erich died at the age of 25 while on an overseas tour of Japan. There is still a lot of debate to this day about how he died. Ric Flair in his book claimed that David died of a drug overdose, and that Bruiser Brody, who was a good friend of his, flushed the remaining drugs that were found in his room down the toilet before the police arrived. That flies in the face of what others have said, not only his family, but the autopsy report as well, said that David died of a heart attack due to acute enteritis, which is a swelling of the small intestine, which in turn caused his small intestine to rupture. On the Heroes of World Class DVD, Kevin Von Erich claims that David had been complaining of stomach pain even before he went on that tour of Japan. I think it was for All Japan. And in fact, he was taken to the ER less than 2 weeks before that trip. He was complaining about dizziness and flu-like symptoms. We can only go by what the autopsy said, and it does back up that theory. And for whatever it's worth, Ric Flair also has claimed in interviews that he was there the night that Bruiser Brody was murdered, and he wasn't. So call it faulty memory or whatever you want to, but he also is not exactly the most factual resource. David was the one who they all thought would be the first to win the NWA World title. They really had high hopes for him. He was the one with the greatest amount of potential, they felt. He never had the chance, and instead, at a tribute show for David a few months later at Texas Stadium, they had like 45,000 people there. It was his brother Kerry, the future Texas Tornado, who would beat Ric Flair for the NWA title. Kerry only held the title for 18 days before dropping it back to Flair in Japan because of Kerry's problems with substance abuse. Kerry was into a lot of different things he probably shouldn't have been. He was doing a lot of shit back then that made him very unreliable. He was not reliable enough to be put in that position for any length of time. The NWA champion was a big deal back then, had to make all of his shots, and they just couldn't trust Kerry. 18 years ago this week, February 11th, 1996, WCW had its Super Brawl 6 pay-per-view. Kevin Dunn beat Brian Pillman in a strap match where the winner would be determined only when their opponent said, "I respect you." This was the infamous "I respect you" Booker Man incident. They wrestled for probably all of a minute. Pillman then just stopped and got on the mic and said, "I respect you, Booker Man," said right into the microphone, and then walked off. Pillman was really trying to get over his loose cannon gimmick around this time, and this was done as like a work shoot. Sullivan at the time was the real-life Booker behind the scenes in WCW. Arn Anderson came out to replace Pillman since they were playing it up like this wasn't supposed to happen. So Anderson filled in for him. They wrestled for a little bit. Ric Flair came out, told them they shouldn't be fighting, and that's how it ended. And also on that same show, Ric Flair beat Randy Savage to win back the WCW World title. 17 years ago this week, on February 13th, 1997, it was a special live edition of Raw, Thursday Live. Shawn Michaels was supposed to defend the WWE Championship against Psycho Sid in a Royal Rumble rematch on the show. And instead, Michaels showed up and he forfeited the title due to what was believed to have been, at least by his word, a career-threatening knee injury. This was the speech where he said he lost his smile, which to this day is still something that they mock him over. He lost his smile. Instead, they ended up doing a Fatal 4-Way match, which I think they were going to do anyway, but they did a Fatal 4-Way match at the Final Four pay-per-view that month in your house. Now, that match was made after Steve Austin won the Royal Rumble in controversial fashion. If you remember, Bret Hart had eliminated him. The referees didn't see it. He snuck back in, threw Bret Hart out of the ring, won the Rumble. So the idea was that they would do this Fatal 4-Way match. Instead of Austin getting his title match at WrestleMania, they said, no. We're going to put you in a Fatal 4-Way match. The winner of that match would then go on to meet the champion, who was supposed to be Shawn Michaels. And so Shawn doing what he did here kind of fucked everything up because he instead gave up the belt because of this supposed injury. And they decided to put the championship on the line in that Fatal 4-Way match. Kind of like when the world title got vacated back in late 91. And the Royal Rumble match, instead of being for a shot at the champion, although back then they really weren't even doing that stipulation yet, but instead the title was put up in the Rumble match, kind of the same idea. Bret won that match, dropped the belt right back to Sid on Raw the next night, and they set up two matches for WrestleMania that year, that being Undertaker and Sid for the title, and Bret Hart against Steve Austin in what would later become a submission match, and one of the best matches in company history, but, I mean, nobody knew that. Undertaker and Sid was not the original plan for WrestleMania that year. The original plan for WrestleMania that year was for Bret Hart to get the belt back from Shawn Michaels. You know, he did the honors for Shawn the year before. Bret was gone for most of 96, came back, and he was heading for the championship at WrestleMania. And we were going to get ourselves a WrestleMania 12 rematch at number 13. When Shawn gave up the belt, again, it threw everything into disarray. And Shawn's got this knee injury, yet the funny thing about it is that Shawn, there he is at WrestleMania, dancing around with this supposed, you know, knee injury, and it was just comical. It was just, obviously he came back like a month later, but there he was at WrestleMania 13, out there doing commentary for the main event. He comes out, full entrance, dances around, looks pretty good. I think he even made fun of it at one point. He looked down at Vince McMahon at the announce desk, and he was like bending his leg back and forth, like, "Oh, look, I'm okay." Like, yeah, what a prick. So it's not hard to understand why Bret Hart felt the way he felt about Shawn Michaels. Did Shawn really have a knee injury? Maybe he did, but he played it up because he really didn't want to do the job to Brett. That's what Brett thinks. That's what a lot of people apparently think. Who's to say? His track record back then was suspect. I tend to believe Brett when it comes to that sort of thing. Also on that show, Rock won his first Intercontinental title from Triple H. This is when Rock and Triple H were both young guys on the ascent in WWE. And there was a lot of professional jealousy later on between Triple H and The Rock, and I wonder if it really goes back to this. This was... Rock was very, very green. He was very, very new. Probably did not really deserve to be the Intercontinental Champion. Didn't last very long as the Intercontinental Champion. He lost it a couple months later to Owen Hart on Raw. I don't know, just a personal thing with me. I just wonder if whatever professional jealousy that blew up later on between the two of them, if you could trace that back to this match where Triple H was the champ, they took the belt off him to put it on this other new guy. We're going to put all of our eggs in this guy's basket. This is the guy that's going to be carrying the company in the future. Let's take the belt off Triple H, who had already been dicked around the year before because of the curtain call crap and had the King of the Ring taken away from him. It's not hard to think that maybe Triple H was harboring more than a little bit of jealousy at that time. And you could trace it back to this show. 15 years ago this week, on February 14, 1999, it was the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. First ever Steve Austin versus Vince McMahon singles match. That feud had been going on for over a year, and they waited until this pay-per-view, right before WrestleMania, to do the first Austin versus McMahon singles match. Not counting the angle that they did on Raw the year before, where Vince slapped them. They were about to wrestle. Dude Love came out to interrupt. That didn't count. On the same show, we had the debut in WWE of The Big Show, the former giant from WCW who had jumped ship. He was not going to be the last person to jump ship from WCW. He may have been the first big star to really make that jump. He debuted at the finish, came up from under the ring, helped Vince. The interference backfired when he launched Austin into one of the side panels of the cage, which came free. And so as the cage panel is kind of swaying, Austin just very casually climbs down and falls to the floor. I actually thought it was a very creative finish. I had never seen a finish like that, nor have I since. And the thing is, you can't do that kind of finish with the chain link the mesh fencing that they have now for these cages. You can't do something like that. I know they've done some finishes before where they've broken one of the side panels. I think they did that once with, was it Lashley and Big Show, Umaga, it was somebody, I don't remember who it was, but where it broke, I think it was Big Show, and he kind of fell out. So we've seen some cool finishes like that before, but this was very unique. And Austin, with that victory, became the number one contender for the championship at WrestleMania 15. Vince had won the Rumble, so he essentially won Vince's title shot at that pay-per-view. 11 years ago this week, on February 10th, 2003... the world got a little less perfect that day when Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig died at the age of 44 in a hotel room in Tampa, Florida. He had been in town for a show being promoted by Jimmy Hart. Medical examiner declared his death to be as a result of acute cocaine intoxication. His dad, Larry the Axe Hennig, also said that steroids and painkillers had a lot to do in his son's death. He was former AWA World Heavyweight Champion, two-time Intercontinental Champion in WWE, U.S. Champion in WCW, and a guy who, at his peak before his back injury, could have been a world champion in WWE had he been given the chance. It was just, you know, bad timing. It was the land of the giants. Hogan had the belt. Warrior had the belt. For a short heel run, though, I mean, why not? I know he was a smaller guy by the standards of that time, but he was, you know, a great heel, and, you know, he could have just had a short run with the belt, dropped it back to Hogan or something, but they never did it. He is my favorite Intercontinental Champion of all time. When I think of that title, I immediately think of Mr. Perfect. He was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2006 by baseball player Wade Boggs. And before people start, you know, talking about how, oh, that was terrible, why have a celebrity induct him? It actually made sense because he and Wade Boggs were good friends. Wade Boggs actually did one of those early skits when Perfect first came over to WWE. He would hit the baseball out of the park. He'd throw the football from one end of the field to the other and catch his own pass. Those were some of the best vignettes they ever did for a new wrestler. You know, it wasn't the same when he came back in 2002 and they tried to replicate them. Today, his son, Curtis Axel, is on the WWE roster. He won the Intercontinental title last year, making them the first ever father-son combo to ever hold that title. 10 years ago this week, on February 15, 2004, at WWE's No Way Out pay-per-view from the Cal Palace in San Francisco, Eddie Guerrero won the WWE Championship for the one and only time in his career from Brock Lesnar, one of the great championship matches in WWE history, thanks to a spear from Bill Goldberg, who interfered in the match, and that would lead to the match between Goldberg and Brock at WrestleMania that year, that fantastic meeting at Madison Square Garden. The spear led to the frog splash finish. Eddie won the belt. In his book, I read Brock's book some time ago, Death Clutch. Didn't come off as being too thrilled with being told that he was going to have to do the job to Eddie on that show, but he did it. You know, he put him over like a champ in the match, and it was a great moment. Just a lot of emotion. Eddie's family was at ringside, including his mother. I mentioned her a little bit earlier. Chavo Guerrero did an interview on Chris Jericho's podcast that's actually very, very good. It's a two-part interview, and I strongly suggest you go check it out. Just be aware, there's a lot of sad stuff in there. It could be very depressing. He goes pretty deep into Eddie's death, what happened, because he was there. And also Chris Benoit's death. He was probably Chris's closest friend for the last several months of his life and his travel partner and all that kind of stuff. So he gets pretty deep into the final days for both Eddie and Chris and the fallout and everything else. And he talked about the moment that Eddie won the belt, and at the time Chavo was a heel, they had been feuding, so he felt like he had to really restrain himself, because when Eddie went backstage and was hugging everybody and celebrating, you know, they were still very much believers in keeping character and all that kind of stuff, and the cameras were rolling as Eddie was celebrating in the back, so he couldn't even go over and give him a hug. He had to wait until they were in private and all that kind of stuff. And just to go back to the Chavo interview for a second, there's a lot of other really interesting stories that he tells, including one where he was down in Mexico. WWE had a house show run down in Mexico. I don't know if it was like Guadalajara. It was one of these towns. And he was programmed at the time with Rey Mysterio. And they went out there and they had this 20-25 minute match, tore the house down, just had a great, great match, got complimented on it by a lot of people and agents when they went to the back. And he tells the story and he says, you know, the only people who didn't come over and say anything, they didn't even acknowledge our presence, was John Cena, who I guess was going to be on next in the main event. And maybe he wasn't too thrilled that he had to go out there now and I guess top the match that Chavo and Rey just had. So Cena said nothing, didn't even acknowledge them, and DX, Shawn and Triple H, didn't acknowledge them or say anything. But he went out of his way to praise Edge, because Edge was in the main event with John Cena, and he says Edge actually pulled him aside and said, dude, that was an awesome match. And he said he and Edge became pretty good friends after that. I know Chavo is not the biggest John Cena fan. When he left the company many years ago, I remember these Twitter rants that he would go on, questioning John Cena being this tough thug and all this other kind of stuff, and criticizing a lot of little things from his matches. So maybe part of it was just sour grapes, but what was really interesting was he tells this story, and when he mentioned Cena, and especially when he mentioned DX not saying anything or acknowledging them and kind of ignoring them and blowing them off, Chris Jericho in the background just says, typical. Typical. And I was kind of struck by that. So, but again, it's a good interview. Two parts. It's up on, you could probably type in Talk is Jericho. It'll come right up. Highly advise checking that out. 4 years ago this week, on February 11th, 2010, it was on this date during a WWE Investors Conference call that Vince McMahon famously announced the death of Survivor Series. Here is the quote. This is what Vince said. We think that Survivor Series is obsolete as far as the title is concerned. It was something that worked many, many years ago in terms of a creative standpoint, various teams competing. Survivor Series, yes, many years ago was one of the original four pay-per-views, but it has outlasted its usage. And it is one of the things in terms of rebranding this year and going forward that will be rebranded. No longer will we have that title. And for those of you who don't buy the dirt sheet stories about how plans change all the time and Vince McMahon can't make up his mind, yeah, Survivor Series is still around today. And now, with all the pay-per-views being on the network, they won't have to worry about it underperforming every year, because they're too damn stubborn to make War Games an annual tradition on that damn show, which they should have done years ago. Now it won't matter. 3 years ago this week, on February 14, 2011, Valentine's Day, The Rock returned to WWE after a seven-year absence. He was announced as the host of WrestleMania 27, the role that I still think would be best for Hulk Hogan this year. I first pitched the idea of Hogan as the host back in November on the Sound Off, and he's coming back soon, and we'll see. I can't see him wrestling. We'll see what role they have in store for him. I still say that would be the best one. 2 years ago this week, on February 12, 2012, TNA's Against All Odds pay-per-view, the opening match between Jesse Sorensen and Zema Ion, ended with an unplanned count-out win for Ion after he landed right on top of Jesse Sorensen's head outside the ring on a moonsault. Sorensen collapsed in a heap. He was paralyzed for some time after that, couldn't move, suffered a fractured vertebrae, was nearly killed on the move. It was a matter of inches that saved his life. It could have been a lot worse. Sorensen did promos later on about how he hoped Zema Ion would win the X Division title, which he did, so that he could beat him for it when he came back, but he never did come back. TNA gave him a job as a production assistant instead, and despite promises he claims from Dixie Carter to him and his mother that he would always have a job in TNA, they released him last summer. And when you listen to shoot interviews that he's done, boy, does TNA come off looking pathetic. It's one thing to give the guy a job and keep him employed for a while and then let him go, let's say, if you're having budget issues or something like that. But if what he says is true and his claims have never been refuted by Dixie Carter or TNA, nobody's ever come out and said that's not true, it's completely baffling that they would make those kinds of promises to him and his family and then renege on them the way that they did. And then when everybody is trashing Dixie Carter on Twitter for firing the guy. This is back when she was doing the Ask Dixie stuff on Twitter. Remember that? For her to go to him and say, listen, let's release a joint statement that this was a mutual decision and you wanted to leave to go pursue other things, all just to take some of the heat off of her. You know, I mean, delusional Dixie indeed. His mother was pretty pissed about that one. I can't say that I blame her. I do love the story that he tells, though, of when he was laid up in the hospital feeling sorry for himself and he was in too much pain to walk. And who should come bursting into his room but Kurt Angle? Unannounced, Angle just shows up and starts yelling at him, telling him to get up and stop feeling sorry for himself and, you know, get on with your life. It's like, I picture Angle just bursting through the wall like the Kool-Aid Man or something. But you know what? After that, he managed to walk down the hallway to the bathroom on his own. So maybe when Kurt's done wrestling, he could have a career as a motivational speaker. Also, 2 years ago this week, on February 14, 2012, it was the end of Vince Russo's run in TNA Wrestling. Dixie Carter posted the following announcement that day on her Facebook page that said, TNA and Vince Russo have mutually parted ways as of this week. The separation is amicable and professional. We are glad for the opportunity to have worked together and wish each other nothing but good luck and success in the future. Blah, blah, blah. That was a great day in TNA history, and that was when I started to give TNA a second look. I just wasn't a fan of a lot of the ways that Russo was booking that show and all the shit that he would try to shovel into a two-hour window. It was just terrible. And the product got better after that. You can say that the product has fallen off, but when I started watching Impact full-time in May of, I guess it would have been 2012, there was a big change in the product overall. It was a lot easier to follow. There was some more wrestling. The storylines actually made sense. It was actually a fun time to be a TNA fan, and you could trace it back to his departure from the company. And now there's a lot of rumors about Russo. Is he back? You know, is Russo back? Is he coming back to TNA? I kind of touched on this a little bit last week. What's interesting, there's another interesting wrinkle to the story here that was reported this week. Wrestle One is the Great Muda's promotion over in Japan. As you know, they have a working relationship with TNA that was largely forged through a relationship with Jeff Jarrett, which is kind of funny that Jarrett's gone now. The whole TNA Wrestle One alliance came about largely because of Jarrett. And they have this working relationship where they're actually sending some TNA talent over to Japan to wrestle on one of their shows in the next few weeks. They're sending the Great Muda and I think one or two other performers to wrestle. I think at Lockdown they're going to be on that pay-per-view. So they have this ongoing relationship, and Wrestle One is very concerned. And this was first reported, I think, in the Observer newsletter. There was more on it in the Figure 4 newsletter this past week, where Wrestle One wants to know if Vince Russo is back in TNA. Is he back or not? Because if so, they don't want to work together. They think Vince Russo is racist against Japanese wrestlers, based on the way he's booked them and other foreigners in the past, not just Japanese wrestlers. TNA did not give them a straight answer. And what happened is somebody from Wrestle One actually called Dave Meltzer on the phone to see what he knew, because they couldn't get a straight answer out of TNA. They called him. That's how panicked they are about this. So nobody seems to know for sure. But I'd say that's a pretty damning sign if they're not giving these guys a straight answer, knowing that this whole relationship could just fall apart over something so stupid as this guy, and they can't get a straight answer out of TNA. Samoa Joe posted a tweet last week that he had just buried the hatchet with Russo. It was kind of random. You know? The Figure 4 newsletter this week had some quotes from an interview that Russo did back in 1999, just before he came over to WCW, that, you know, you might say, well, who cares? That's an interview from 15 years ago. Well, you should care, because this has a lot to do with Russo's mentality when it comes to foreign talent. This gives you a little bit of insight into what he thinks of foreign wrestlers and why, for example, he booked things like pinata on a pole matches during his time in WCW. And this could be why there is a rift in the relationship between TNA and Wrestle One. It could go back to a lot of what he talked about here in this interview. This is what Russo said at the time. This was after he was asked if maybe title matches here in the States could at least have more clean finishes like they do over in Japan. This is what Russo said. He said, I've been a wrestling fan my whole life, and I will live and die by this. Believe me, I write this shit. It is hard enough to get somebody over. You will never, ever, 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 ever see the Japanese wrestler or Mexican wrestler over in American mainstream wrestling. And the simple reason for that is, even myself, I'm an American, and I don't want to sound like a bigot or a racist or anything like that, but I'm an American. If I'm watching wrestling here in America, I don't give a shit about a Japanese guy. I don't give a shit about a Mexican guy. I'm from America, and that's what I want to see. When I was a kid watching wrestling, how am I supposed to care about a guy whose name I can't even pronounce? I've never watched Mexico or Japan because I don't give a shit. I live here. That's all I care about. End quote. That was Vince Russo from 1999. I disagree. I think that there's a mentality in WWE, even without Russo there. This is not just a Vince Russo thing, but there is this mentality that, for example, a Japanese guy can't be a main event level star in WWE. And this is not me speaking from some kind of inside knowledge like, oh, I'm so smart. I'm a fan. I have two functioning eyeballs. I've been a WWE fan for 20 some odd years. And there has never been a time where there is a Japanese guy that they have pushed as a main eventer. Never. Never, ever, ever. There have been guys that have come along, Tajiri, guys like that who were popular, but they were largely booked as comedy figures. Look at Kai and Tai, okay? Look at the Mexicools. Now, when it comes to Latin talent, you look at a guy like Alberto Del Rio. You know, he got a big push. He was a multiple-time world champion. Rey, although Rey was always a star. Del Rio, in that case, they were looking for a big Latin star, big Mexican star, and it didn't quite work out. Sin Cara certainly didn't work out the way they had hoped. So there's actually more stories of them at least attempting to push, you know, like a Mexican talent, for example. Japanese, though, find me one. Find me one guy. They had that guy in WWE in like 2006. I forgot his name. He had like the geisha girl as his manager. His name will come to me. I can't remember it. They kind of gave him a little bit of a push, but never at a main event level. And it's not like there aren't Japanese talents out there that are good enough where if you gave them a shot and you brought them over here, you know, we just heard about Kenta going over to WWE to kind of work out and train at the Performance Center over there. And you bet your ass that if they would have made some kind of offer to him, he would have at least entertained the offer. I know he said he only went there to, like, live a dream and just say that he went. Believe me, if they made him an offer and wanted to bring him over, he would have thought long and hard about that. And he's a really talented guy. And I could see somebody like him, if they put the machine behind him, getting over. I'm not saying he's going to be at the level of John Cena, but he could be at the level, I think, of a Punk or a Bryan if you really gave it time. And if he learned English, because that's very important. You have to learn the language. I do agree that you will not get over if you do not learn the language. You have to at least know some English, because it's so important to be able to get on the mic and cut promos and that kind of stuff. Sin Cara, you know, the guy, the original Sin Cara, didn't bother to learn English. They wanted him to. He never did, so he couldn't speak any. But he had the chance to get over because he had the mask. They marketed him a certain way. I still think he only would have gotten to a certain level, but he at least had a shot. But if you bring, like, a Japanese guy over, no mask, no nothing, it's just them, they're a really good wrestler, you've got to be able to communicate with the audience, and their main audience is the American audience. I don't care what kind of business they're doing overseas. WWE is based here in the States. They do most of their travel and most of their business here in the States, and you've got to at least know the language. I do agree with that. But the rest of what he said there, complete BS. I don't buy that for a second. And it's not surprising to me then that the people over at Wrestle 1 would be a little concerned. And you look at what he did when he went to WCW with the pinata on a pole matches and, you know, booking guys in comedy gimmicks and stuff like that. It's not too far off, I guess, than what Vince McMahon would do, but I wouldn't want to work with that guy either if I'm a foreign talent. I wouldn't want to work with them. I don't blame him. So right now it's all rumors and conjecture. There's no evidence that Russo is back, although you watch some stuff on Impact, and you wonder, you know, having men against women, men calling hot women skanks, which was an old Russo calling card, you know, bash the hot girls, probably because Russo couldn't get a date in school. So, I don't know. I don't know what's going to end up happening with that. It would be a shame, I guess, if this working relationship fell apart over something like this. But I think the fact that they gave a non-answer, and the folks at Wrestle 1 are all frantically calling around to, you know, all these writers at, like, The Observer and stuff, hey, do you know what's going on? Because they're not giving us a straight answer. That doesn't bode well. That's not a good sign. If you have mailbag questions, please email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I'm still digging out from all the emails. I am hell-bent on getting back to people who emailed me, you know, 6 weeks ago. So bear with me on that. But keep sending me your questions. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I'll be live tweeting during Raw this week, as always, and the pay-per-view next weekend when we come back with predictions here on the Sound Off. I think I mentioned last week we were going to do predictions. I misspoke. I thought the pay-per-view was this weekend. It's actually next weekend. So we'll have our Elimination Chamber predictions and all that kind of stuff next weekend on the show. So follow me on Twitter, Facebook. We're all over there. We have a profile page, fan page, and a group. So you can apply for membership to our closed discussion group. I will approve you. I think we now are beyond 1,300 members. A lot of great discussion going on there. So join us on there. You can listen to this show in full every week, download it or stream it directly off thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and we're in iTunes. And I haven't asked for this in a while, but if you are one of the listeners on Stitcher, iTunes, leave us a review, because it only helps the show when people leave positive feedback about it. So you can do that in iTunes. You could also do that on Stitcher. That would be great if you guys can rate the show and leave reviews and let people know what you like about the show and why they should listen. So if you do that, I appreciate it. We're on YouTube as well. We have a YouTube channel. Type in the name of the show. It'll come right up. And you can check out bonus Sound Off extra videos that I've recorded, reviews for different things. And I post other clips. In fact, I'm going to be on I did an interview with another podcast talking wrestling last week. The audio of that from the Brad Gilmore show is going up on Monday, so I'll link to that on Twitter, and I'll put the audio up on our YouTube channel if you want to listen to that. We had a pretty good discussion about WrestleMania, WWE, TNA. It's always good to have the back and forth, so I'll have that audio up on YouTube in the next day or two. And I think that about covers all the important stuff. I appreciate your support, as always, for the podcast. Keep on spreading the good word, letting other people know. And we'll be back next weekend, episode 315 of the Solemonster Sounds Off with Elimination Chamber predictions. The final sound off before the network launch. So if we have any other breaking news to talk about, we'll go through all of that. This is the last week, I think, of the Attitude Era scratch logo on WWE television, if I had to venture a guess. It looks like that new network logo is going to be the new logo. Like it or not, I'm not a big fan of it. Maybe it'll grow on me like a fungus over time. But we're starting to see the new logo show up on the tags on some of their t-shirts and stuff like that. So I'm pretty sure that when the network launches, that network Raw on the 24th, that probably will be the first night we see the new logo in the corner of the screen and in the signature at the beginning and everything else. I could be wrong, So this week coming up on Raw and SmackDown could be it for the old Scratch logo from the Attitude Era. So the end of an era. Enjoy it while you can. Be well. Stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week. And until then, take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Salamonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Sierra Hotel.
India.
Echo.
Lima.
The bad.
And I am back to headline WrestleMania, so deal with it.
And the ugly.
Then they have a hat. The hat itself is actually nice. It looks like a nice hat. What's wrong with this is it's a beard baseball hat. The entire brim of the hat is a hairy beard. Who the fuck would wear this?
Well, mostly the good.
You can't disregard the fans. You can't disrespect the talent. I think we all want to see a change.
Salamonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on the Salamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.